How's the worst Christmas?
Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? This is the second of my redone waterlogged episodes, the first being the third part of Dave Dye that happened last week, or whenever I'm going to put this out. And this week is with Nigel Roberts. So again, a huge apology and a huge thanks to them. I'm assuming it was a little bit annoying for them to have to go through things twice. But I guess on the plus side, I got to spend another hour in the company of both Dave and Nigel, which was very pleasant. Really enjoyed both conversations. Just moving on to Nigel specifically, one of the things we didn't really talk about that much was, you know, I worked into Nigel for 2 or 3 years at AMV, and, you know, I never got a chance to discuss how beneficial that was for my own copywriting. I told Nigel the first time we did this chat that when they moved to Ogilvy from TBWA a few years earlier, I genuinely and very seriously considered calling up a headhunter and saying, can you please get me into Ogilvy? Because I wanted to work under Paul and Nigel because their work was just so fantastic. And I guess I'm born under a pretty good sign because the mountain came to Mohammed, and within a fairly short space of time, Nigel and Paul had become my bosses. And I did indeed do much better work under them and learnt a huge amount from them. And, you know, I just wanted to express my thanks for that. I hope to speak to Paul at some point in the near future. We're just trying to work that out. But as a copywriter, working into Nigel was a, you know, massive privilege, in my opinion. I'll just give you one illustration of that. It wasn't actually my work, but I went in to chat about something else. It probably was my work we were talking about. And there was a poster doing the rounds at the time, I think for Adidas, that had a big picture of David Beckham. I'm assuming it was for some World Cup or some Euros, probably 2004. And the headline next to it was Cometh the Hour. So picture David Beckham and Cometh the Hour. And Nigel showed me the ad and said, wouldn't that just be so much better if it said Cometh the Hour and a Half? And I thought, yes, it would be so much better if it was Cometh the Hour and a Half. The funny thing was, when I mentioned that to Nigel a couple of weeks ago, he couldn't even remember saying that. So that's just an illustration of Nigel would just, in normal conversation, toss off a just fantastic improvement to an already award-winning headline. And that's really what it was like working for him. So you always wanted to do your best work for both of them. You know, they have very high standards, but they were both really good guys. You know, I've spoken to Paul an enormous amount since they stopped working at AMV. But working for Paul and Nigel was fantastic, and particularly Nigel. So with that now clarified, I think we can get into my chat with Nigel Roberts.
Hi, Nigel. Thanks a lot for making the time to chat with me.
Hi, Ben.
I think before this, I'll have revealed that we've had this conversation already, and my incompetence has led us to need to do it again. So I must doubly thank you for making the time for a second occasion. That's very kind of you.
Thank you for the opportunity to make less of a hash of it than I did the first time. So I'll treat that as a rehearsal. So
okay.
Hopefully this one will be better.
I'm sure it'll be brilliant. So I think like a lot of people I've spoken to, I think it'd be interesting to find out how and why you got into advertising in the first place, if you wouldn't mind going into that.
Sure. Well, I grew up on a farm in the Midlands, and I think I was about 3 years old when I sort of realised that farming wasn't exactly a career that that I was particularly keen on following. Going outside 365 days a year in all weathers and getting kicked and crapped on by various animals and whatever else. So I certainly didn't want to do that, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do, to be honest, and kind of plodded through school, really. And then halfway through my A-levels, my elder brother asked me what the hell I was going to do with the subjects that I was doing. What was I going to do for a career? And again, I thought, I haven't got a clue. I was doing geography, economics and maths. And when it came to thinking about what I could do with those, I was quite worried that I could get into a very tedious sort of job that I wouldn't get any satisfaction out of at all. So I dropped maths and did art instead, and then did the usual route of foundation course and whatever, and went to an art school in South Wales to do a graphic design degree. And I didn't really know anything about advertising at the time, or about what the job entailed, at least. But about halfway through, I realised that graphics wasn't really doing it for me, or graphics, or whichever, and about the D&AD workshop. So I spent the last year of my course doing a couple of D&AD workshops, so travelling down to London on a Wednesday and getting a brief from an agency and working on it for the week, and then going back the following week to be critical. That was a real awakening for me. I loved it. I thought it was great, the whole conceptual strategic side of it and everything else. So that was the decision made, really, that's what I wanted to do. And I think it was Lawrence Bloom at BNP that informed me that you had to be incredibly patient and lucky to get your first job in an agency worth working for, at least. But it seemed like it was worth giving it a go anyway. So like a lot of people, I did about 12 months or so of going around in circles and seeing people with my portfolio. And at first I was trying to find a copywriter to work with, because having done a visual course, I naturally assumed that I'd be the art director and work with a copywriter, but I couldn't find anyone. And there was a sort of shortage of good copywriters that I could tell. I think a lot of people had teamed up when they were at school, art school together and whatever. So, and then Greg Delaney, I did a placement at Delaney, Fletcher Delaney, as it was back then. And Greg suggested that as I'd done my own copywriting for the work in my book so far, why not change over, call myself a copywriter, find an art director, because there were lots of people looking as art directors at the time. And his advice was just get your first job. If you find an art director, get a foot job in an agency, and once you're in, then you can always change later on. It's easier to change over once you're in. That would be the better thing to do. So that's what I did. So I teamed up with an art director who was already on a placement at Saatchi from there. But once I was in, I sort of decided I quite liked being a copywriter, actually, and stayed with it. So
your first agency that you had a job at was Saatchi's in this is the late 80s, early 90s that we're talking about?
Yeah, very end of the 80s. So as I say, the art director, Tony Hector, who now is VCCP, he was on a placement at Saatchi's, so I went in and worked with Tony. And I think we worked for about 6 months, 3 months on placement money, and then I think another 3 months for free, until eventually they sort of got used to us hanging around and decided just to give us a permanent job for the princely sum of sod all. So
it must have been quite exciting going to Saatchi's at that time, because, I mean, I don't know if everyone listening to this is even would remember those moments, but I mean, Saatchi's was the only agency, and kind of probably still is, that people outside of the industry really know, and that must have been its kind of heyday. So, what was that?
Yeah,
like?
No, it was incredible. It was fantastic. As you say, everyone had heard of Saatchi's largely because of the Conservative Party stuff that they'd done and all of the PR on the back of that, but also they were famous for doing so many great campaigns. Intercity, Castlemaine Forex, Silk Cut, All Transport, British Airways. They had some of the best accounts around. And it was amazing to sort of get in, to land a job in the agency that was pretty much top of your list, really. And the people in there were incredible people in the creative department, particularly Paul Arden, who was the creative director at the time. This was in the days before there were such things as executive creative directors or chief creative officers or whatever other title somebody's come up with. So Paul was the creative director overseeing everything that came out of the agency. So even as a very lowly junior, right at the bottom of the pile, you still had regular contact with him, and he assessed your work on a daily basis. And so, yeah, a fantastic opportunity to learn a lot.
And because this is good, I mean, I don't think there's going to be too many things where we can kind of really properly connect to Paul Arden. So what was he like as a sort of person? Was he temperamental? Was he easy to get along with? What was he like as a boss?
He was, I think, like Mary Weir touched on, working for Paul Arden in one of your previous podcasts. He was famously eccentric in kind of all the best ways. He was clearly a very sort of creative mind, but he was, I think, the most sort of inspiring side of it was that he was really passionate. He cared so much about the work, and he wanted it to be as great as it could possibly be. He couldn't bear the idea that anybody had sort of stopped too soon on something and it wasn't as good as perhaps they could do, or perhaps the brief, the opportunity or the client might permit. So he was constantly pushing people. He was known to tear up an ad, whether it's concept stage or sort of proof stage or whatever else. If he decided he didn't like it, he would. He wasn't afraid to sort of display his displeasure at things, but it was all for the right reasons. He was funny. He was sort of amusingly eccentric, but a great creative director.
All right,
and that is why so much of the work was so good, and it was. He partly because he was still producing work as well himself at the time, so you knew he was constantly reminding you of why he had the right to be judging your work. So,
yeah, I think it's always that lead by example thing is always really a powerful thing to have in a department.
Yeah.
And so, how long were you at Saatchi's for?
I think I was there for about 3 years, maybe 3 towards 4 years, I think. And it was that was the beginning of the 90s then. And we were well into times going bad for the agencies. And so, yeah, there was a very sort of unpleasant spell where everybody knew there were going to be redundancies. And the day that word got around that somebody had been called down to Paul Arden's office and been informed that they were being let go, and everybody sort of sat there dreading their phone ringing and having that call. And unfortunately, my phone rang, and it was time to go down and see Paul and receive the news that you really didn't want to hear. But they were very good about it. It was a very good time, and at least I felt like I'd made a start in the industry. So hopefully, I'd have a chance of finding something else. But it did mean that I was then on my own again as a copywriter, because. For various reasons, my art director and myself, we went our separate ways. So I needed to find another art director. As I said, I decided I wasn't going to change over from being a copywriter myself. So I got, as a lot of people do, a list, got in touch with the headhunters, and got a list of art directors who might be looking for copywriters. And that's where I met Paul Belford.
Cool. And what was it about Paul that you think sort of made you want to work with him that sort of you thought would click as a working partnership?
He's just obviously very bright. It wasn't, you know, he's I hope you won't mind me saying this, he's got a very analytical mind. Very highly qualified in areas that you wouldn't expect of a sort of very accomplished art director. Yeah, we worked well together. We were very critical of the work ourselves. We both sort of pushed and pushed and pushed until we were happy with what we got conceptually that was worth showing to whoever our creative director or whatever it was. And Paul, I think we had similar preferences for the sort of work. We both liked good, intelligent, clearly persuasive advertising. We teamed up. Started putting a book of speculative campaigns together and looking around agencies, and Yeah, I'd only met a couple of art directors, but I didn't really feel the need to meet any others after I'd met Paul. It's just I suspected that we'd work well together, and I think it was a good combination.
And from there, was the first place you guys worked at, was that DNB&B?
It was, yeah. Yes, we got a job at DNB&B in the early 90s, and I was working. It was when Jeremy Pemberton was creative director there. And I don't think it was an agency that was particularly close to the top of most people's lists of agencies to work at. It wasn't as if they were doing some of the sexiest campaigns or anything. But when we got there, it was great. There was a lot of good people there. And and I think we continued to learn there from good people. And we got to work on some fairly good big brands, Australian Tourist Commission and various others and whatever, and it just, yeah, it felt good, certainly good to be back in a sizable agency that where there were opportunities. Yeah, it was good. I'm not sure it was an agency that we felt that we'd sort of stay there for an enormous amount of time, but we were still very much sort of in our apprenticeship sort of stage.
Yeah, I remember going to Crits at DNB&B when I was at Watford in the mid-90s and actually really kind of liking the vibe. This is when they were at Victoria. I don't know if they were ever in another part of London, but I kind of liked it. And they did have some really decent brands there to work on. So, I mean, I don't know what has happened to it now as a placement. It probably merged five times.
Yeah, I think it got sort of merged into Bates, didn't it, or something. When Paul and myself were there, it was in St James Square, just by Piccadilly, so it was well located, and it was a nice little corner of the centre of London. It's a shabby old building, but it was a sort of corridor of little offices. But at least we had an office, which is not many people can say these days. But it was good. There were good people there, and they sort of worked hard. And a lot of people have gone on to do great things in other agencies, and so it was kind of, I think it was one of those big agencies that was always going to be dominated by a sort of layer of management that was possibly nowhere near the work, or possibly even in the country or anything else. So it disappeared, unfortunately. It wasn't going to sort of keep building. I'm not sure whether they lost business or what caused the merger or anything, but I think it ceased to exist as DNB&B a couple of years after we'd left, I think.
Yeah, and was that where you did The Other End of the World Is Nigh?
Yeah, that was on Qantas, which was just, I can't exactly remember what was going on at the time, but I remember we had the idea and got it made and shot, and I think it was our first award of any real significance. I'd had a couple of things in DNAD at Sarties, but to actually win a proper award was great. So yeah, sort of we got a taste for it then.
And from then you went to Lucas Delaney, and I was going to say, how did that happen? But I actually know how that happened. So I was going to just, I remember reading this out last time, but when I got in touch with Dave Dye to have another conversation, he gave me the following information on your transfer from DNB&B to Lucas Delaney. So I'll just read out his email. He said,
sure.
When I was made head of art at Lucas Delaney, Tim told me to go and find an art director to work with Chris West. I'd seen some Teachers 48 sheets that I thought were very well art directed, and they were from a bad agency, DNB&B. These are his words, of course, not mine.
Well, according to Tim, every agency is a bad agency.
So I thought the art director must be good to do that there. I found out who'd done them and got him in, a chap named Paul Belford. I liked Tim, thought he was good, so I talked to Tim, said I'd found someone, told him how much he was on. Tim told me to offer him a job. I felt so grown up, I'd never offered a job to anyone at that point, so I called Paul with the good news. I was going to rescue him from the mediocrity of DNB&B and bring him to the glamorous, award-winning world of Lucas Delaney. Boy, will he be excited. When I called him and told him the good news, his reply was, "What, not with my writer?" And Dave said, "No, but it's good here, you'll be fine." And Paul said, I'm going to have to say no. I like my writer. So Dave said, what, you're going to stay at DMB&B rather than come here? And Paul went, yeah. So slightly embarrassed, feeling like he'd failed, Dave told Tim. And Tim said, he'd rather stay at DMB&B. He said, apparently. He said, so what's his writer like? And Dave said, he's good. So Tim's reply was, fuck it, let's take them both on. If the writer doesn't work out, we can see what we can do then. So that's how you join. And I'll just say that before, when I told you that story before, just in case anyone doesn't know, you didn't know that that's what happened. So
no. I wasn't aware of it at the time. So obviously I'm very flattered by that. And obviously, I owe Paul a huge debt of gratitude for it. I was aware that they'd been in touch, and obviously it was a fantastic agency. It was possibly the best independent agency, certainly one of the best independent agencies in the world. It's a superb client list that anyone would give their right arm to get to work on. So hearing that Paul was actually prepared to turn that down in order to continue working together is great. It's very good to hear. So if you're listening, Paul, thank you.
And I think Dave talked about his first week being a bit of a baptism of fire at Legas. What was it like when you first arrived?
Yeah, I think it was the same for everyone. I can remember our office was actually right next door to Tim's office. And by next door, it was sort of Tim's desk was the other side of the sheet of glass from our desk. So effectively, I was virtually sitting next to Tim, and our first brief that we got, we had to think about it for a few hours, and then went into Tim. I think it was me holding the piece of paper that was our response to the brief, and handed that to Tim. And without looking at it, he just looked at us and said, "What's this?" And we said, "It's an ad." And without mincing his words, he informed us that it wasn't an ad, and to go away and do some more. I don't think he bothered looking at it clearly. We'd messed up there, so we went to where I ended a lot more ideas. And then, as a few people have said before, Tim likes to see a good selection of work, and he'll decide whether any of it is good enough. And if it isn't, then you know about it. So we quickly learned that you had to work a hell of a lot harder than we had at DMB&B or at Surtees. Was a hard working agency, but as everybody that's had experience of Legas, particularly in the 90s, knows, it was a really hard working agency. It was good. You knew that if you could survive working at Legas Delaney, if you could keep Tim happy with the work you were presenting, then you could probably work anywhere, really. And you got into a pace of working that you found that sort of rhythm, really, and you got used to it. So it was daunting to start with, but as soon as you did sort of get into that rhythm of working, it was very satisfying. So, I mean, that's why I think of all the agencies I've worked at, and there have been quite a few, that was possibly one of the most satisfying times, a couple of years at Legas, just because the amount of work that you did and the satisfaction in the actual work that you did. It was great. And we were scared at first, but it quickly became clearly a great place to be. So again, I'm very grateful to Paul that I got to be there as well with him. So
great. And I think one of the pieces of work you did there is probably one of the most enduring that you've done, and that's the Patek Philippe line about you never actually own one, you just pass it on to the next generation. How did that come about?
I can't remember how long we'd been there. But it was a pitch that had come into the agency, and again, I can't remember who we were pitching against, which agencies or whatever, but it came in, and it was, I'd never heard of them before. But clearly they made very splendid timepieces, and like most, they sort of traditionally talked about how splendid the engineering was and everything else, and they started, I can't remember how much they So I think they started at about £12,000 a piece back then. So clearly fabulous things, but how to sort of give them any kind of campaign idea, nobody was quite sure really. So we worked on that for a while, and I can remember saying to Paul that I always liked the idea of having a nice expensive watch. Most people do, but I sort of thought that my excuse for ever treating myself to one of those would be that it wasn't really for me. It was sort of, it would be something to pass on to your children at some point in the future. And we thought that that was possibly a good insight into the market for watches such as that. So we worked on that. We did a few different ways of expressing it on the sort of whole generations thing. And showed our thinking to Tim, and he liked it, and it developed into one of, I think we pitched for two campaigns for it, and yeah, and we won the account, which was great. But the line only came later on, once we campaign idea of it being something you'd pass on to. I think the couple of executions that we put together for it, it was, I can't remember who the photographer was, very good photographer, and Paul did all the art direction for it, and I was left to write the copy on about sort of 50-60 words. And I can remember Tim telling me that it wasn't right, and making me write it again and again and again, and I think I wrote it about 50 times. And towards the sort of late end of the 40s, I sort of thought, well, I kind of still liked the original way that I was writing it, so I went back to the sort of second or third version of it that I'd written, and brought back some of the elements of that, showed it to Tim, and he finally said that now it was getting somewhere, and that ended up being the copy that ran on the first couple of ads, and the last couple of sentences were that you talked about how wonderful the watches were and this and the other, and it ended with, in fact, you never actually own a Patek Philippe, you may look after it, blah blah blah. And after those first ads had run, I don't know whether it was the client picked up on it, or it was. I think Paul and myself had actually left Lagos by that point, but it transpired that those last two lines of the copy became elevated to the headline on the ads, and they've been there ever since, which is great.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think they're still there now. It seems like every time I pick up the Spectator or the Economist or something, They're always, it's always there on the back, so that's
yes,
pretty unusual. Yeah, no, this image.
It's good it is a good insight that a lot of watch brands sort of struggle to have themselves, and so it's great that it's lasted this long. I know that Lagos have gone through several rounds of giving the strategy due scrutiny and to see whether it still holds the same value and everything, or whether the client would be better off changing it. But every time they've decided that it's right to stick to it. So long may they do so, hopefully.
And Lagos was obviously still a really good place with a really good department, and you know, you were doing some great stuff on The Guardian and Pepe and stuff like that. So why and how did that come to a conclusion? Was it about how tempting the next offer was?
I think it was, yeah, exactly that. It was a brilliant agency. As I said, the client list there was incredible, getting to work on Timberland and Porsche, and Barclays was still there, and the BBC and Adidas, and there were so many great accounts to work on. And we were surrounded by amazing creatives, Kim and Tony and Dave Dye and Sean Doyle and so many people, Dave Beverly and Rob Burley. It was a great, great agency. And it was purely that, I think, yeah, we went from there to, yeah, Tom Hudson, who was there, he moved to Baines Fair Sharkey Trot as creative director. And shortly afterwards, he called us up and asked us if we'd like to go to Baines Fair Sharkey Trot as head of art and head of copy. Although you'll tell me now that he asked Paul, and Paul refused to go with that, maybe. But so it, that was we'd been working together for, I think, four or five years by then. And that was about 8 or 9 years since I started in the industry anyway. So the chance to be head of copy in an agency and continue working with Paul, obviously, it was too good to resist, really. And with all due respect to Bainsford Sharkey Trot, they had some amazing accounts as well. I don't think they were quite as amazing as Legs Delaney, but they did have brilliant, brilliant accounts that clearly you could do some good work on. I think they just won the Waterstones pitch before we joined, but that was there to be done. And I think Marlborough was their main account that sort of paid all the bills, so that made them a very sort of stable agency, and they had a great little office in the corner of Soho Square. And we felt guilty, I think, telling Tim that we were off, and we were very flattered that he was quite disgruntled by the news. It would have been disappointing if he'd just said good, sort of. but he was quite annoyed about it. And so off we went to work for Alp Tom at BST.
Yeah, and I think...
Which then, of course, it didn't end up as BST for very long at all. It just kept... It had sort of... it kept merging every half an hour.
Yeah, I guess you merged your way into TBWA, but the fascinating thing about Waterstones would be... I think that's the campaign that must have elevated you beyond, you know, even where you'd been at Legas Delaney, because... I think The Power of Books, it got a DNAD nomination, didn't it? And that was just the first of many just fantastic executions. So what was it like working on that account?
Yeah, that was great. As I say, I think they'd won the pitch just before we joined. And I don't know whether it was a sort of joining gift from Tom's for us to work on that, but clearly it was an opportunity. Everybody knew the brand already, Waterstones, and it was very respectable sort of chain of bookstores. And their brief was, we love books. And so I can remember early on working on it and talking with Paul, and the feeling was, well, rather than just say that we as a brand love books and just assert that and hope that people believe it, just try and do some ads that demonstrate that they love books. So let's sort of try and explore some insights into why books are so damn good. And so it was a very sort of open brief, really, that allowed us to look for insights. And then once we got a bunch of lines suggested that books were very splendid things. As usual, they were presented as very roughly drawn scamps and everything else and bought into. And once they were approved, then Paul started thinking about the art direction. And everyone knows that he did a very splendid job of it. And so that campaign, while we were very pleased with the work that we'd done to date at Legas and Legas Delaney and everything else, I think that was our first big proper campaign that we felt like, yeah, we kind of owned that. That was that felt like that was the start of what we really wanted to be known for, really, that sort of campaign. Print we always loved, and it was more straightforward than the sort of very complicated process that you go through with TV and everything else. Whereas we'd sort of shut the door and work away until we'd got some concepts, and then craft the lines, and Paul would craft the art direction and everything else, and then as long as nobody disagreed vehemently, we got to make them.
So. Yeah, and I think what was great about that campaign is it had some lines that were obviously totally embedded in the world of books, but I think a couple of the best lines even sort of went beyond that and gave you a sort of life lesson, like why learn from your mistakes when you can learn from someone else's, was like one of those really obvious truths that no one ever really said. You go, why would you go around making all these errors and having a terrible time because of it when people have already done it for you? And I just thought that pops into my mind fairly regularly. There's a new Tim Ferriss book out, which is a sort of collection of his podcasts and all the knowledge from there. And I was just thinking about that headline the other day as I was reading it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it seemed to be a great...
That's very good. It's kind of my favourite kind of headlines, really, are ones that give you something to think about. And hopefully it should be a fairly inarguable truth. And if it is an insight that strikes a chord and everything else, then it just feels like you're going to appreciate the brand behind it, really. And I've those sort of headlines. When Greg Delaney first suggested that I should present myself as a copywriter, the first thing I did was wade through the DNAD annuals up to that point and study the work that the best copywriters around, obviously Tim Delaney and David Abbott and Richard Foster and various others, the sort of work that they'd done and how they wrote their headlines and how they wrote the copy. And that was the kind of that good sort of little nuggets of wisdom were the sort of stuff that I loved the most, and that's what I really tried to emulate as much as I could and still do, I suppose.
And that is the end of the first part of my chat with Nigel. If you want to hear the second part, you can find it exactly where you found the first part, or listen to the entire episode on SoundCloud. All the links are at benkay.com. Thank you.